Now, what I'm going to do today, here in this discussion and then later in the workshops, is talk about sort of the inverse of what Denver was talking about. Denver talks about losers. I talk about winners. We're looking at the Constitution. And what I'm going to stress this morning is the Constitution as a political document. The usual textbook view of the Constitution is that it was divinely inspired. As Denver said, that it was in some sense inevitable. This was going to work. It couldn't fail to work because this is the hand of God touching man. It's the product of philosophers, the Enlightenment. This is the engineered government. Gary Wills refers to it as an invented government, an inventing America. That it's egalitarian, the last best hope of mankind, democratic. And the thing is, none of these things are true. It wasn't divinely inspired. It arose, the argument I'll make will be, out of very specific political necessities of the time. It wasn't a preordained success. If you think about America at that point in time, who's to the north? The Brits. Who's to the west? Native Americans and the French. Who's to the south? This means, what had France, England, and Spain been doing to one another for the last 300-400 years? Beating the crap out of one another. Constantly at war. So they're surrounded by the great powers of Europe. And they're this little fledgling country with the Articles of Confederation, which doesn't provide for robust central authority. There's nothing egalitarian in the original Constitution. I take that back. There is one point of egalitarianism. Each state gets the same number of votes in the Senate. But that's the only mention of equality. Equality doesn't come into the Constitution as a concept until 1868, with the passage of the ratification of the 14th Amendment. And it's certainly not democratic. And one of the things we'll talk about this afternoon is the hatred and the fear that Madison and Hamilton have of democracy. And if you think about the original Constitution, there's only one federal office that is elected. Remember what that was? House of Representatives. Senate's elected by state legislatures. President's elected by the Electoral College. And the judiciary is nominated by the President and confirmed by the Senate. One of the great anti-federalist arguments against the Constitution was that it wasn't democratic. And they were right. It wasn't. Because they didn't want it to be democratic. Now, this is one of the things that state curricular requirements seek to address, to try to replace myths with facts. And so this is one of the things that we'll be talking about today, which will animate my conversation with you this morning and also this afternoon. All right. The Constitution as a political document. This phrase, which comes out of a piece that John Roach wrote in 1961 in the American Political Science Review, is, I think, the sort of touchstone for what I'm talking about today. And the crucial line is raising the framers from immortality to mortality. Now think about that. That's counterintuitive. Raising from immortality to mortality. Usually think about it the other way around, mortal to immortal. But Hamilton's point, and this is why Roach cites him, Hamilton's point is that we think of the framers as gods who were doing philosophically grounded work, that were above the political fray, that were representative of a general sense of self, of public interest. And that's not true. What they were human beings with very specific interests, representing states and regions with very specific interests, who were, and this word has been somewhat discounted over time, politicians. They were really good politicians. And if there's a takeaway from what I talk about this morning, the ultimate takeaway is that the fact that they were very good politicians enabled the Constitution to get written and ratified by the states. It is a political document above all. Now, let's dig into this notion of the Constitution as a political document. Two basic points: context informs actions and meaning, and that the Constitution is a response to this context. Now, Denver gave you a really nice picture of life during the Articles of Confederation and the difficulties that were perceived by nationalists. There's a massive national debt, and Denver renders it in pounds, which is cool, because that enables me to say, we owed a ton of money. I'll be here all day. I'll be here all day, don't worry about it. There are various state currencies, and they're cranking them out like crazy because it's good for debtors, and debtors are most of the people, and this is problematic for the money class and creditors. There are tariff wars between states. They're building tariff walls one to another to try to protect their local agricultural interests, their local industrial interests, to the degree there are such. And when one state passes a tariff on the goods from another state, the other state responds with a tariff, and so it's frustrating the development of a national economic system. This is what brought the Annapolis Conference into being. Annapolis Conference was called to suggest amendments to the Articles of Confederation to allow the national government to regulate commerce among the states. But only five states showed, as Denver said. Now, two of those states were Virginia and New York. And two of the delegates from those two states were Madison and Hamilton. Now, they hung around Annapolis for a while because they were waiting for other states to show up. They just never showed up, so they never had a quorum. But Madison and Hamilton and others there were able to talk about the difficulties that were imposed by the Articles of Confederation on developing a national economic system. Then there's Shays' Rebellion, which sends a tremor through the propertied class, because the people are taking up arms and occupying governmental buildings to stop the collection of payments on mortgages and things like that. So this is the context. I mean, the Constitution did not fall from the armpits of the gods. Right? It arose out of a specific historical context with specific historical problems. And these guys had to solve them. Now the Constitution is a response to this. It is the result of compromise that were driven by these sort of local particular interests of different states, different delegates, but also a general concern for the public interest. How to protect this new collective of the United States of America, which Article 1 of the Confederation said, the perpetual union of these states. The perpetual union, lasting forever, of these states. Now, the goals of the delegates are essentially two, and I think this is something that helps give you a hook for your students. When you teach this, these guys are politicians. Their goal is to supplant the Articles of Confederation. To do that, they have to achieve two things. So there are two goals. One, they have to agree among one another. If they don't agree among one another, there's nothing to send to Congress or to the states. So those 55 white guys, at one point in time or another during the convention, had to come to some agreement. But that wasn't enough, because their agreement in Philadelphia was not sufficient to supplant the Articles of Confederation. Their second order goal was that they had to agree on something to which the states could agree. They had to have something they could sell. Those are two different goals. Right? But they inform what is going on in Philadelphia. Now, one last thing about this, because we'll talk about sort of micro compromises and the individual compromises that are necessary to create the Constitution. But realize there is macro strategy involved here as well, an overarching strategy on the part of the cosmopolitans, the nationalists. Congress prompted out of the Annapolis Conference to call for a convention. But the convention was charged with, and this is a specific quote, the sole and express purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation. That's the phrase from Congress. Convention in Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation. Do we call it the sole and express purpose of amending the Articles of Confederation convention? It doesn't really roll off the tongue well. We call it the Constitutional Convention. Why? Because they didn't amend the Articles of Confederation. Why? Because Madison and Hamilton and other nationalists had decided you couldn't fix this. You can't band-aid. You've got to start all over. And so what does Madison do? He spends months before the convention preparing for the convention and designing something that is introduced as the point of discussion early in the convention, the Virginia Plan, the Randolph Plan. One of the things you know from running meetings over time is one of the great ways to sort of influence the direction of the meeting is to write the agenda. If you write the agenda, you control the flow of what's going to be discussed. You may not get everything you want, but you've structured the debate so at least it's around those things you think important. That's what the Virginia Plan did. Now, coming out of the convention, and so the Virginia Plan was essentially the agenda for the Constitutional Convention. They talked about the Virginia Plan. They revised and modified the Virginia Plan. But they're working from Madison's template from the beginning. When they come out of the convention, under the Articles, what was the vote required to change the Articles?
Unanimous.
What did the Constitution require for adoption?
Nine
states. Why make that change? Those who write the rules win the game. Why make that change? Easier to get 9 than 13. And they knew this in part because Rhode Island didn't even go to the convention. So Rhode Island is just sort of AWOL at this point in time. So they changed the rules. Then they decide we'll send it not to state legislatures, but the special conventions drawn and created to consider whether or not to ratify the Constitution. Now, Brunsman pointed out that this had been done before, that there was this notion of ratification convention for state constitutions. But what is the strategic advantage of sending the new Constitution, the proposed Constitution, to state conventions as opposed to state legislatures? Because whatever powers this new national government gets will be drawn essentially away from states. So you create conventions where you can try to get your peeps elected and you have a better chance of winning. This is genius. It's very political. It's very strategic. And what we talk about this afternoon, when we talk about the Federalist Papers, is also part of this political thrust. It's a propaganda voice. Sarah Huckabee Sanders comes out in the White House press room and gives talking points for the president. Federalist Papers are talking points for the Constitution from Madison, Hamilton, and from Jay Fonn. So this is all part of the overarching political strategy. Constitution is a political document. Now, having sort of established the macro part of it, let's go to the micro part. Remember, they have to agree among themselves, and they have to come up with something that they can sell to the states. How do you teach this stuff to your students? What I've developed over time in trying to get them to pull together the various compromises that are made at the convention are three general conceptual hooks. The punt, split the difference, and vagueness. Now, a punt is a football term. When you can't get a first down, you kick the ball to the other team, you try to regroup so that you can score later. Okay, it's a strategic move on the part of a team. There are two punts of relevance to introducing students to the political nature of the Constitution. One is on the question of new states. The second is on the question of voting. And by the way, this presentation, I think all of the PowerPoint presentations exist in a cloud, excuse me, in a box in a cloud. I don't know where that is. Somewhere out there. So you don't have to worry about writing all this down. You can print it up. But Ponce, New States, and voting. Then split the difference. Each side gets something. Positive sum solutions for those of you who love game theory. Split the difference. Compromises. The election of the president, slavery, and representation, which is incorrectly spelled, I discovered yesterday. Representation is also a compromise, but not as big as representation. Okay? And then finally, vagueness, leaving terms sort of open to interpretation. So for example, I mean, you see this all the time here in today's politics. Who's opposed to, who's in favor of equality? Everyone's in favor of equality. That's great. What about affirmative action? Maybe, maybe not, right? Different conceptions of equality inform that. But if you take equality at a very general level, everyone's for it. So vagueness is a useful tool to create compromise. And the classic example of that is federalism, the division of power between the national government and state governments. All right, so let's unpack these just briefly. The question of new states. The basic question here is, what are the conditions for admission to the Union? Because we have all this territory to the west. There's a notion that at some point in time you'll be framing new states. Denver mentioned that the articles dealt with this as well. But the question is, when do you bring them in? What are the criteria for bringing them in? What kind of population do they have to have? Will they be on an equal status as the original states? Will they have restrictions on voting? What about slavery? All of these questions, and these are all contentious questions. So the tension here is between sort of a national definition of state status and states' rights, the ability of localities to determine their own sort of political structure and destiny. There's no consensus on this question at the convention. So what do they do? They punt. Now, when you go, bless you, to PowerPoint school, when you go to PowerPoint school, they teach you not to put large blocks of text into PowerPoint slides. I never went to PowerPoint school. In fact, the only time I use PowerPoints is when I talk to groups like this. So I just throw large blocks of text up willy-nilly. And if you think this is bad, it's going to get much worse. Gear up for it. This is the way they solve the new states problem. And again, this exists in the box in the clouds. You can download it and then pull it out from there. Now note what they say, and this is genius. New states will only be admitted by Congress into this union. Okay, fair enough. Congress will do this. So we know who's going to admit new states. But no state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states, without the consent of the legislatures of the states. And that's it. So what are the criteria for bringing new states in? How many people do you have to have?
60,000.
What territorial size are you talking? What kind of state government do you need? Are any of those criteria spelled out there? What's spelled out there? Congress will do it. And not only does it say Congress will do it, so they punt it to the future, they CYA, which is a technical social science term, which apparently you know, which is good. They protect themselves. No new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state. Who does that protect? The existing states. No new state shall be formed by the junction or two or more states. Who does that protect? The existing states. Who wrote the Constitution? The existing states. So they couldn't decide what the criteria for new states would be, but they knew that they should protect themselves. So they punted this to future Congress. Congress can figure out what the criteria would be. Since we can't agree, we'll let them decide. For right now, this is what we can agree to, and this is what they get. Article 4, Section 3, Subsection 1. Another punt. Who gets to vote? Now, Professor Brunsman, in his conversation earlier, pointed out that some states had very generous voting regulations. Pennsylvania, universal white manhood suffrage. Okay? And remember, when the Constitution says we the people, it really means we the people who count, which are white guys of various stripes at this point in time. The Constitution becomes more democratical over time, but in the original, we the people is basically white guys. But the question is, what white guys? And who gets to vote? And again, you have the same basic tension. States' rights against nationalism. Do states get to determine this? Does the national government get to determine this? And you're only talking about voting for the House of Representatives because it's the only federal office you're voting for. You also have questions of equality and consent. And while the Declaration of Independence has absolutely no constitutional authority in the United States, it established no government. It did nothing other than essentially ask the French for money, in grandiose terms, and list out a series of grievances as part of the end, part of a point of a petitioning process with Great Britain. Governments arise from the consent of the governed. Notions of equality. Notions of the importance of consent. So these are in play here when you're talking about who gets to vote. There's no consensus at the convention, so what do? They punt it. And this is the resolution they come to. Article 1, Section 2, Subsection 1. Who gets to vote for the House of Representatives? The electors, the voters, in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for the electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So who gets to determine who votes in federal elections? State governments. If you can vote for the assembly in your state, you can vote for representatives to Congress, to the House of Representatives. Okay? And if you want all white guys to vote, great. If you're in South Carolina and you want 15 people to vote, fine. That's the deal. So this punts the decision as to who gets to vote to the states. Why? Because they can't agree. And since they can't agree, they try to come up with a compromise that allows them to agree in general to the document and then be able to sell it to the states. Now, split the difference compromise. The first one is the election of the president. And there are a number of different proposals before the convention. The original Virginia plan has Madison's original Virginia plan has the president being selected by the Senate, which would have been apportioned based on population, because the Virginia plan had everything apportioned based on population. There wasn't a lot of support for that in general. There were other positions that the state legislatures should elect the president. Some argued that state governors should elect the president. Still others argued that there should be a popular election of the president. Democratic. So what do you do when you've got all of these things? And realize this is an office that hadn't existed. The Constitution creates an independent executive. The Constitution creates an independent judiciary. These things had never existed in the United States before at the national level. So how do you choose this? And making this even more complicated is the fact that sitting at the very front of this convention is the guy that everybody knows is going to be the first president if the Constitution gets ratified. It's going to be Washington. All right? So the real question here is, what's going to happen after Washington either shrugs the mortal coil and decides to go back to Mount Vernon? Who's the next president? How are we going to choose that person? They can't come to any kind of consensus, so they compromise by splitting the difference between all the plans. You ready? Most of Article 2 of the Constitution, and Charlie Lee's going to show you a cool mapping technique for the Constitution when he gives his presentation. Most of Article 2, most of the words in Article 2, relate to the Electoral College. And the reason they relate to the Electoral College is because they are inventing this out of whole cloth. There had never been anything like this before. Have any of you ever played the game of Mousetrap? You know of the game of Mousetrap. It's a Rube Goldberg device. It's a ridiculously complex machine to accomplish a very simple task, capturing a mouse. But it involves a foot knocking a marble down the mouse, and this is, and you lose pieces to the thing constantly, and then you're done with it. But for the, you know, the day and a half after Christmas, say, it's a lot of fun. That's what the Electoral College is. It incorporates a bit of everything. So, who elects the president? The Electoral College. Right. Who chooses the electors? That's up to the states. So if a state wants to have gubernatorial appointment of electors, what can a state do? Pass a law that has the governor appointing the electors. If the state wants state legislatures to appoint the electors, they can pass a law and appoint the electors. What if a state wants popular election of the electors? They can pass a law and do that. Yeah. Fine, fine, fine. Everybody gets a little bit of something with that. Okay. But remember Madison's original plan. The Senate would elect the president. What happens under the terms of the Constitution is that if there is not a majority in the Electoral College, the election shifts to the House of Representatives, with each state voting as a block. Each state having one vote. That sounds a great deal like the Virginia plan. Okay? And again, go back. Washington's going to be the first president. Who's going to be the second president? Those who sort of helped put this compromise together thought, okay, we'll satisfy the individual interests of different states by, you know, weaving all this stuff together. But after Washington's gone, what you're going to get are a bunch of favored son candidates. So there'll be candidates from individual states that'll have electoral votes. There'll be, say, candidates perhaps from regions, but no one's going to have a majority of electoral votes. Which means that who chooses the president? The House of Representatives. And that's what Madison and the Nationalists wanted in the first place. So it's like, yeah. But they didn't foresee the rise of political parties. They thought political parties was a sign of the corruption against which they were revolting when they left Britain. They were going back to a purer form of republicanism. The parties developed. And once parties develop, you end up with two candidates for the presidency. Which means that one of them is most likely going to end up with a majority of electoral votes. So the original plan for the Electoral College goes up in a puff of smoke because they couldn't foresee the future. They were great guys, but they couldn't foresee the future. Right. Even with that, there's a problem. And that problem is called 1800. Made famous by Hamilton, an American musical. Jefferson and Burr tie in the Electoral College. Now, it was clear that Jefferson was fronting the Republican ticket. Burr was tacked on largely for political reasons, trying to pull in some of the New England states. But Burr is tied with Jefferson, so technically this goes to the House of Representatives. And Burr decides, you know, I could be president. That'd be a good job for me. And Jefferson says, what do you mean? And Jefferson says, I could be president. So this goes to the House of Representatives, and after a long, drawn-out battle, eventually the Federalist engineer Jefferson becoming president, which irritates Burr and leads to the end of Hamilton, an American musical. But this points out a problem with the Electoral College. All these words didn't fix this. So you know what you need? More words. The 12th Amendment, which is designed to deal with the problem of 1800. And again, we think of these things as, you know, they're looking at the clouds and trying to divine great political principles. They're not. They're trying to solve the problems they've got at the time they've got them. And that's the 12th Amendment. All right, so, second split the difference compromise, slavery. And slavery is an issue that hangs over everything that happens at the convention. And in fact, all of these other compromises have a tinge of slavery to them. Right, so realize that is there. But they had to confront slavery directly. Franklin's at the convention. Carried in on the litter every once in a while because he's really, really old. But he's at the convention, and he's the head of the American Abolition Society. So there are abolitionist interests at the convention, but there are also slave interests at the convention. The notion that you can end slavery at the convention is a non-starter. Why? They had to agree among one another. Slave states aren't going to agree to get rid of slavery. Even if they did, they had to sell it to people in the Union, the other states. They're not going to agree to end slavery. So slavery is a given. Constitutionally, it's a given. The question is, how does the Constitution treat it? States' rights, property rights, human rights, those things are in place here in contest when they discuss these things. There's no consensus, so what do they do? Three specific provisions of the Constitution. The word slavery never appears in the Constitution, even though it overshadows everything in the Constitution. This is the three-fifths clause. Representation, three-fifths. Where does this come from? Slave states wanted their slaves counted when population was determined for the House of Representatives. Why? They would get more representation. And most of the people lived in the North. Okay, so they wanted to count everybody they could. Northerners said, no, you can't do that. Why? Because Northerners are superior moral beings? Well, there were slaves in the North, but not nearly the number in the South. But their position was, you know, there is a moral dimension. They say, if you're not going to give these people political rights, they're not, you shouldn't count them for political units. But there's a more self-interested concern, and that is, we don't want you guys to have more votes in the House of Representatives. We like having more votes in the House of Representatives. So what's the compromise? And this is, you know, the three-fifths compromise, three-fifths of all other persons, i.e. slaves, will count toward determining representation. Well, what does the North get out of this? Gets a constitution, but it also gets direct taxes. Okay, so the national government generates more revenue as a result. That's the three-fifths clause. Right? This is the importation ban, Article 1, Section 9, Subsection 1. This says Congress can ban the importation of slaves in 1808. And guess what Congress does? It bans the importation of slaves in 1808. Who's that a win for? Abolitionist sentiment. And then finally, the Fugitive Slave Clause, Article 4, Section 2, Subsection 3, which essentially says if a slave gets into a free state, that free state has to help return the slave. I own the second finest sedan, or actually vehicle, created by God, a 2008 Hyundai Acera. If my Hyundai Acera is taken from me and moved to Oklahoma, what does the state of Oklahoma have to do? To get it back. That's the Fugitive Slave Clause. Because a slave is the functional equivalent of a car. It's owned by another human being. Who's that a victory for? Slave states. Then finally, representation. And I won't spend a lot of time on this because this one is so logical that students don't even see it really as a compromise or a difficult compromise. Other than to say, this almost brought the convention down. Where is political authority? Okay, the tension is between states' rights and nationalism. Madison's original Virginia plan had the states, had the Congress, both the House and the Senate, apportioned based on population. That would benefit larger population states. The smaller states, not just southern, but smaller states, freaked out. That's a technical social science term. Because that meant that they could get crushed legislatively in the national government. And there was this general fear of centralized authority. So they counter with the Patterson plan, the New Jersey plan, which has a single house legislature where each state has one vote. The Cosmopolitan said, whoa, that's just like the Articles of Confederation. That simply won't work. So what do? They split the difference. Representation by population. Representatives in the House by population. Senate, equal status. Each state gets two senators. Every side gets something. Now, the last compromise is based on vagueness, the last sort of conceptual categories. You put these things in bags to try to teach your students. This basic question is Goldilocks in. Do you remember being taught about Lotzian conceptions? This is a product of the 19th century. The great social scientists, the Grimm brothers, whose stories were in fact Grimm. So they're aptly named. German bedtime stories. Do what your parents tell you, or you will be killed. By the bear, by the witch, but you will be killed. Sleep tight. Goldilocks is one of these stories. And remember, Goldilocks, the bed was too hard, the bed was too soft, the bed was just right. The chair was too hard, too soft, just right. The porridge, too hot, too cold, just right. Goldilocksian means that you're looking for the just right balance of power between the national government and the state governments. But the problem there is what? What's the problem in coming up with that just right balance? Well, what's just right to you might not be just right to you. So you're trying to find this sort of golden mean. States' rights, nationalism, this is a major tension. They couldn't come to any kind of consensus on the scope of the power of the national government, although everyone there thought the national government should have more authority than was the case under the Articles. So what do? You leave it very vague. What you do is you articulate in Article 1, Section 8, the enumerated powers of the federal government. Federal government has the power to tax. How do you know that? It's Article 1, Section 8. Has the power to declare war. How do you know that? Article 1, Section 8. Has the power to regulate commerce. How do you know that? Article 1, Section 8. Boom, boom, boom. You're listing out powers. That sounds a lot like the Articles of Confederation. Okay? But then you get to the 18th subsection of Article 1, Section 8. And it says it also has the power to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. All laws necessary and proper. What does that mean? And it depends on what you mean by necessary and proper. When I was a kid, I used to tell my parents, or ask my kid, you really didn't tell my parents anything, but I would ask my parents on, say, Thursday night, if I could have the car on Saturday. And they'd say, why do you need the car? Or why do you want the car? And I'd say, because I need the car to go to the Pizza Hut, because that's where we hung out. And they would say, you don't need the car, you want the car. I said, no. Au contraire. I need the car. And they'd say, why? I said, well, I have to hang with my chum. That's crucial to my social development. You can't just socially develop in school. You have to socially develop in pizza. And they said, no, you can have your chums over here. And I said, no. That wouldn't be good, because you're here, and that would constrain my development. And they said, well, no, you would like to have it, but it's not necessary for you. And I said, no, it's absolutely essential. And my bottom line position was, what about the women? If I'm not at the Pizza Hut, they don't have access to this. And my parents' response was, oh, the women will be just fine. And it turned out my parents were correct. The women just did fine without them. But anyway, that's a difference in the notion of what counts as necessary. Is it useful and convenient, or is it vital and crucial? And we use that word both ways. So they could agree upon it at the convention, and they could sell it to the states. Because you could spin it your way, because it's a vague term. Article 6 is the supremacy clause, so whatever the federal government can do is supreme law of the land. And then, as Carol will point out in the next discussion, the 10th Amendment is stuck in, and I'm not going to... She thinks she owns the word expressly. She does not, by the way. I know, that's fine. It's in the second article of the Articles of Confederation, and it's not here. But the 10th Amendment is a response to the notion that the federal government would have too much power, because it says the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the people or the states respectively. That's a statement of political authority and the division of political authorities. That's the federalism problem. Okay, so all of this stuff is in the original Constitution, and it's in the original Constitution because this is what they could agree to. So what's the takeaway from all of this? Context informs actions. You can't understand the Constitution without understanding late 18th century America and what led up to late 18th century America. The Constitution is a specific response to specific problems at that period of time. There's nothing magical about it. The framers were not philosophers. They were pragmatic politicians that created a document based on compromises over things on which they differed, and in some instances differed very strongly. That said, you can guide pragmatism by knowledge. And the framers were working within a philosophical context, an intellectual context, that was informed by the Enlightenment. You see that in the Federalist Papers. And one of the things you have to teach, because of all of those, are concepts out of the Federalist Papers. So we'll talk about that tomorrow afternoon. Those are the SRs that are touched upon by the things that we talk about here today. And we'll talk about the Federalist Papers and the philosophical dimensions of the Constitution this afternoon. Thank you very much.